Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. Today is Thursday, June 11th. You know, I just had to burp as the music was playing. And I've been fantasizing of burping on the air because, you know, I drink carbonated drinks.
Do you want to fulfill that fantasy?
I might, because Howard Stern likes to do that. And I thought, God, that would be cool, you know?
Yeah, do it.
So if I have another one coming, I'll do it.
Yeah, please. Do you want this to be like a you give warning and we all wait?
No,
you and I?
No, just happened.
Okay, great.
I just let it out.
I hate when you're like on a date drinking. When I was in my early 20s, I drank a lot of beer because beer was my thing. And after 25, beer just makes me like super like I just start like leaning back. Like I walk into a room like tummy first. I just can't breathe. It's just too much. Too
really
many bubbles.
Fills you up.
Yeah. Like one beer and I feel like I ate a loaf of bread.
Wow.
And so being on dates when you're drinking something bubbly. Now I drink champagne, so I have the issue with champagne. But, you know, you're on a date. Maybe you just finished dinner and you're sitting there burping and you know your like burp air like stinks. You're trying to like blow it the other direction. You're like without doing that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I was a kid, my brother would burp and then blow it in whatever direction I was.
Really?
Yeah.
That sucks, man. That's shit.
That's just standard big brother protocol.
Yeah, right?
You know? Like everywhere I went was just, yeah. I was just in a cloud of whatever smell he wanted
Hopefully
me to be in.
Hopefully he doesn't do it anymore, huh?
He still does.
He still does it?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
30 and 40 years old and he still does it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So, yeah, that's always been very uncomfortable for me.
I'm sure.
Just, you know what I mean, though, when you have to do something like that on a date? The next morning is always worse if you do a sleepover situation because you're just, like, holding everything in the whole night.
Yeah.
You know, in the morning, you're like, can you leave, please?
Like farts and stuff like that.
Yeah, you're like, can you just please leave?
I know.
I gotta go. Or they're like, let's go to breakfast. You're like, yeah, a public place would be amazing.
Yeah. Or just don't sleep here overnight, you know, just go home.
Yeah, go home. So uncomfortable just dealing with tummy aches the first few months.
It is. And it's not a few months. I mean, I was married for many years and I didn't, you know.
Really?
I just never felt comfortable farting in front of anybody, really.
Really?
I mean, even guys, you know. Like Don and Doug, we were talking about them before we went on the air, my friends. They always fart, like, right there, you know, and they, like, make a whole big deal out of it, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the fuck, man? What are you guys, like, you grown men, you know?
It's just natural. I mean, it's such a complicated topic, right? Because it's like, on one hand, farts are so funny and also so gross. Yeah. So it's like, and also so natural, you know? It's just something that unfortunately happens, you know? So, I mean, I remember dating my first boyfriend, this guy, John. I remember we were watching Family Guy, and I think Peter Griffin, the dad, he, like, farted or something, and I started laughing because he, like, farted to the tune of something. And I started laughing, and John was 2 years older than me, right? I was 19, he was 21, not a big difference. And he goes, ugh, and rolls his eyes. I'm like, what? And he goes, maybe when you're 21, you won't laugh about things like that. I'm like, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're literally 2 years older than me.
Yeah, when you get older, yeah, right. And he's wise and much older.
Yeah, so much older and so much wiser. Because experience means you don't laugh at farts.
Right. Yeah. But so we have a good show for you today. We're going to have a guest calling in a few minutes. This ends up being a very sensitive issue because of the recent occurrences with police and everything, and this is a former cop, so, and he's got a book, so we're going to find out about his experience with the LAPD, which does not have a great reputation.
No. On the East Coast, it does. On the East Coast, they think LAPD is, like, top-of-the-line cops.
Yeah, they've always had problems. I mean, the Rodney King one, and and some corruption and shit. I don't know. That's what he's going to talk about.
I mean, I can't imagine any source of power not having some dirty laundry.
That's true, yeah.
You know, no matter like what it is.
Abuse of the power.
Yeah, I mean, think of even a small town, the things they cover up. The town I grew up in wasn't a small town, but there are certain things where, I don't know what it's called, but certain police stations are kind of independent and don't have to report back to the government.
Oh.
So they could put you in their jail and no one would really know.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And the town I grew up in was one of them.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I don't know if they still are, but.
Yeah. But talking about small towns, I started watching a show called The Outsider on HBO. Do you have HBO?
I have HBO Go, but I never really use it.
Yeah. I got HBO Max because I have Hulu and they added HBO to it for a few more dollars. So, and there's a lot of shows I want to watch, like Westworld. I wanted to watch The Outsider that I'm watching. That's a Stephen King book that came out like last year. And it's really good. I mean, it's about finding a boy that was molested and murdered very violently. And the only evidence points towards the nicest guy in town, who is the baseball coach for everybody, you know?
That's always the person that you gotta look at, you
right.
know?
But then they realize he was, I mean, there's witnesses that saw him with a boy, but then they have a video that shows he was in another city, another town during the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how can he be in two places at the same time?
Sure.
That's a Stephen King kind of book.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna give it away because I know the way the story unfolds, but I wanted to see it on TV, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's always interesting to watch the TV version or the bit film version
to see how someone else visualizes it. Yeah,
sure.
I don't know how many episodes. I didn't really look. I think maybe six or something they have all together because it's a limited series. It's just based on the book. So we'll see that. Then Westworld, I want to watch next, like the third season.
I heard Westworld is really good.
Yeah, it is. Did you ever see it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, you got to see it. It's very good.
Man, I can't get wrapped up in the. I just keep. Yeah, it's just like such a time eater for me. I get so like.
I know.
I just finished a season of something and I'm like, okay, I'm free now. You know? I feel like.
It's like you're invested in it.
Like,
right?
I feel like chained by the things that I want to finish watching. You know? Like, I feel like it takes away a piece of my freedom. Like, it's like I don't have a choice.
Yeah, like it interferes with your life.
Yeah, it does sometimes.
Oh, man, the responsibility.
I know. It's very serious. It's very, very serious.
Wow. Yeah, and also they have a lot of relatively new movies like Joker and what else was it? So some movies I didn't see, so that might be cool, you know?
I feel like movies come out so much quicker now.
They are, but now they, if you notice, they put them immediately on TV because nobody can go to the movies.
I know. So sad.
I know, man. We'll talk a little bit more about the openings and everything. A couple things. The stock market, the Dow Jones is down 1,300 points today, which is a lot, because of fears about the economy. Although, you know, things have not been as bad as we thought they would be. Like unemployment is now dropping down to 9%, so that's a lot better than it was last month and all that.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring this up is, you see, even when the market goes down, some stocks go up like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So this morning I get up. I don't know what happened. I usually get up at like 6, right? So, and I put a snooze on for 5-10 minutes and then I get up.
Mm-hmm.
This morning I wake up, I see it's like 7 already. I'm like, what the fuck happened?
You overslept.
I overslept. I mean, because I pressed the stop instead of the snooze, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I overslept. Can you imagine? I mean, if this happened to me like on a tight schedule, I would have been freaking out, you know?
It happens, though. I hate that feeling.
Yeah.
You wake up like almost suddenly. It's very discombobulating, you know? I've woken up before at the time for other jobs where I've like had to, like if I had to be at work at 8 o'clock, I've woken up woken up at like 8:03 and I'm like, oh my shit. God. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm like shaking. I pick up my phone. I'm like trying to dial work. I'm like, I'm like, I just woke up. I'm sorry. Of course, you like contemplate being like, I got a flat tire, you know?
Yeah. I know. I take naps and usually I have to come back here at night to run shows. So I set the clock. If I was late with something like that, I would kill myself, you know?
Oh, no.
Because people wait for their show and then I wouldn't show up, you know? So this is the first time it ever happened to me that I can recall.
That's a pretty good track record.
Overslept. But I don't even remember what I did with the alarm clock. There was a burp. I could have let that out.
Oh, man. I'm so used to like
suppressing them.
So polite.
But we'll do it. If it happens during the interview, we'll do it then. The guests will love us, right?
Yeah.
So,
especially a nice ex-cop,
right?
Nice and relaxed kind of guy.
I know.
He might be. You never know.
So, but when I finally got up, I had to catch up to all the trading and everything, and I see the stock is going like fucking crazy. I'm telling you, it's like going up and up and up and really fast, and then it drops. So first of all, the thing is this, I've had maybe like 8 straight days of not making any money on the simulator, right?
Yeah.
Red days. And if that's not enough to make you feel like a loser, I don't know what does, right? Actually, I guess actually using real money would make you feel more like a loser. But when it's reinforced every day, you go, what the fuck? So that's the part. The psychological part that you have to learn too.
Right, that they were talking about. They're like, don't let it get to you. And as much as you can say, like, other people are in the same boat or have experienced this, even pros have experienced this, it's still hard in the moment to wrap your brain around what feels like failure.
Yeah, you know, and I'm a student. I want this to happen quickly.
I know.
But it's not happening quickly.
Patience is a virtue.
Yeah. So now I read that it takes probably 4 to 6 months on the simulator, and then maybe it takes you a couple more months to actually be consistent with your profits, more or less, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm looking at quite a bit of time still. So, but there's obviously a lot to learn. I mean, as you can see, in the beginning, I was like making money easily. Yeah, go in 10 minutes, make 300, 500 bucks, 1,000 bucks. Oh, this is easy. Great. I'm going to be rich.
You're probably playing higher stakes now.
Yeah. Then I was. Because I didn't understand what I was doing, you know?
Gotcha.
So more or less, it's just like, so in other words, I traded not the way I would normally, right? When you actually have money.
Yeah.
So that's probably why. And I'm learning, and that's what they're saying, you know. It's like any profession, you know, it takes time, you know. I mean, to be a doctor, it takes you, 7 years of school or something, you know. To be lawyers, it takes a long time. And you can make more money than they do.
Sure.
And if you want to really feel good, yesterday he made, the day before yesterday, he made $113,000 one day.
Oh my gosh.
Yesterday he made $133,000. Can you imagine? I mean, this is for the whole year. I mean, this is for like 2 years worth in one fucking day. In the morning. So now you see why I want it so badly?
Yeah.
Okay.
But imagine how, I mean, I saw
but
before.
But he's done it for 10 years, you
even
know,
if so. You made $1,000 a day, I would see how you would want it so badly.
$200 a day. You know what? $200 is a side job. I'd be happy. That's $4,000 a month.
Yeah, great.
You know?
That's an awesome extra income.
It. Yeah.
Totally.
So that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not looking to make that much money right away, but give me some winners, you know? So
yeah, but once you start winning, it's going to be that much sweeter.
Right. But, and you also get overconfident. So it's good that all these things happen now before you use real money. You
got to kill the ego.
You really do.
To be successful, truly and successful.
There's a lot of FOMO going on, fear of missing out.
Oh, yeah. I always forget what that means until someone says it. I'm like, wait, what is it? I'm so bad at that.
There's a lot of that. I mean, yesterday after 133,000, he's still looking at the stock after he finished trading. He's like, man, maybe I should go back. I can't stand watching
this. Yeah, maybe
this.
He can make an extra 20K on top of
that. But he says, I can't stand like not being this because it's like, you know, you don't want to miss out.
Yeah.
But
that would be so sweet.
Right.
You're going to have to teach me.
Well, let me learn first.
Yeah. I'm like, I want to know.
Yeah, let me turn some profits first on paper money, and then we'll see what happens, you know, when we go into real money. But, yeah, here comes the phone call.
Nice.
So we'll take that, and then we'll continue talking about this, because it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it fires me up, too, a little bit.
Yeah. Good morning. You're on the air. Is this Al?
Hello.
Sam, how are you?
Good, Al. Good morning to you. I'm here with Jen.
Hi, Al.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. What's going on this morning?
We're talking to Al Moreno. Are you calling from L.A.? Is that where you live?
Yeah, I live actually in Long Beach, Belmont Shore.
Okay, cool, cool. Well, that's part of L.A. Is this where you grew up in L.A.? Were you born here? Up here?
I was raised in South Central Los Angeles with 11 brothers and sisters, an ex-con father, in a home under 800 square feet, gang-infested Florencia 13. So it was a hell of an upraising.
Wow.
Wow.
But one of 12 children, and your father was a con?
Ex-con, yeah.
Ex-con. Now, the 12 children, were they all from the same father?
Yeah, they were all from mom and dad.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. What's it like living in a family like this? I mean, obviously, you feel you grow up needing some attention, no?
Well, we grew up hungry. You know, there were three tiny little bedrooms, a bathroom that was so small that when you opened the door, it hit the toilet. We were the poorest family in the whole community there.
Right.
And it was just one, crucible after another. But, you know, all in all, we, all the kids did pretty well. They, I made sure that I was the second oldest and pretty well the one at the helm the whole time, and fought like hell to stay out of the keep my brothers out of the gangs.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you grew up in a gang infested area like you described, in a family that's very poor. I guess your prospects of going bad are pretty high, huh?
I was arrested three times. When I was in the second grade, a Catholic grade school, I had problems kind of like reading like with the rest of the kids, and also my math was just awful. Many years later, I found out that I had an industrial case of dyslexia and dyscalculia, which is a neurological problem where, you know, you have problems ciphering out, you know, words and numbers. And to add insult to injury, that year in 1954, in the second grade, I was also diagnosed with late Calvus Perthes, which is a really rare child's disease. It affects the hip. And I was on crutches and a sling for 2 years.
Wow.
And then I was on a Forrest Gump type full metal brace for the next 2 years with an elevator shoe on the right side. So I had my hands full. It was tough. I was a F&D student all through grade school and high school, and got so fed up. I dropped out of school in 1965.
Wow, you had all the odds stacked against you, you
for
know,
sure.
and then you grew up and you became a cop.
Well, that was after I had served with India Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines as a rifleman and fire team leader in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Got back in 1969, and then on September the 17th, 1970, I applied for the Los Angeles Police Department, and it took me 5 years to finally get an academy date. I was disqualified 9 separate times for erroneous medical disqualifications. They just weren't hiring a lot of people of color and women back in the day.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that's perseverance right there.
Yeah.
What made you want to continue, even after being rejected by them, what made you want to continue? Like, what was the spark that, why didn't you say, let me go elsewhere?
Well, I was born, in fact, when I was diagnosed with late Calvus Perthes in 54 at Children's Hospital, Los Angeles, I spoke to my doctor's name was Dr. Pierce, and he set me up on the examining table and looked at me and said, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up, little man? And I just, in a bumptious manner, said, I want to be a policeman. So I was born with that to protect the realm and, you know, sort of help people out, Jane. And I was very focused, and regardless of what I was, you know, what was going to come before me. I mean, after serving in the Marine Corps and going through that hell, there wasn't anything I couldn't handle here in the States.
I can imagine. Yeah. I mean, you went through hell and back in Vietnam, I'm sure. Wow. So, I mean, you were able to actually go into combat after you had your brace and everything on your leg and all that?
Yeah, the Marine Corps needed bodies so damn bad in 1968 that I actually went to a doctor and had him trump up a letter for me and then submitted it to the Marine Corps, and they swooped me right up.
Wow.
Jeez,
man. I mean, you've gone through some stuff, and we haven't even started talking about your experience in the police department. So, you're a tough man, obviously. And to know, to me, when you emerge from something like this, when today, you have kids who are just like suicidal because the social media doesn't go the way they want. And then you look at someone like you and you go, you know, this is like real life.
Yeah.
You know, this is like, this is what it's about, you know, survival.
I have a friend who works in the children's psych unit, and she says sometimes these young teenagers come in and, you know, they're threatening to kill themselves, so they automatically have to go into the crisis center. But they're threatening to kill themselves because, like, their boyfriend or girlfriend broke up with them, or, like, they got into a fight and their parents took their cell phone away. Like,
right.
You know, it's like we have things like that.
That's happening. Well, Moscow page, you know, the Chinese, North Korea, and Tehran are developing hard-ass little boys and girls, and you know it's just America's lost like right around two generations with this politically correct society where they have the safe rooms where everybody gets an A, everybody gets a trophy. These are the men and women that are going to run the country here in the next 10-15 years.
You're
and
right.
It scares the hell out of me.
I know. And especially in times like this where it's so uncertain what's going to happen, you know.
It's a different approach, that's for sure.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your book, Al. You wrote a book called L.A.'s Last Street Cop. And this is about your experiences, Hollywood Freaks, the Aryan Brothers, Brotherhood, and the LAPD's homicidal vendetta against you. So let's hear a little bit about this. How did your career start at the LAPD? I mean, was it good then, or did it start?
I graduated 17th out of finally 47 people. We started the academy class with 63, and we graduated 47. I came out number 18 and number one physically.
Right.
When I went to, once you graduate, you go to one of the 18 geographical divisions and you work patrol. And I was assigned to Venice Division. And by the time I was just about done with my probation, I was leading the division in felony arrests. I had this natural instinct. And I think a lot has to do with where I was raised, you know, in the hood.
Mm-hmm.
And I just excelled in every assignment that I ever went to, and then I went to Hollywood Division and again did really, really well. And then the Los Angeles Police Department started their first ever gang suppression unit, and that was in 1977. And I was one of 40 from the entire department to get handpicked to get on or to work this gang suppression unit.
Uh-huh.
And by the time we got to the 5.5-year juncture, I had accumulated over 71 commendations. That's a bit on the unprecedented side for that time. And more than half of them were for disarming gang members without using lethal force. In fact, one of the rating reports stated El Marino recovers more firearms than anybody in the unit, however, has avoided an officer-involved shooting. So I was exactly the kind of officer that our public wants out on the street.
Yeah, absolutely, to protect and serve. And so you grew up with good values, obviously. you know, and a lot of ambition, you know. I mean,
yeah.
It's amazing to me how far you've gotten. So how long were you in that division in the, with the games?
Well, so, you know, our unit worked all five geographical divisions in Central Bureau, Hollaback, Grand Park, Central Northeast Division, which was part of, which is East L.A. and the north part of South Central. That's where the gang wars were, you know, occurring. Los Angeles is recognized as the gang capital of the world.
Wow.
And so the math was wrong when they started this whole, you know, this whole thing to suppress the gang violence in Los Angeles. When you look at 40 officers work at, you know, versus 450 gangs with anywhere from 60 to 75,000 gang members. So,
wow.
I mean, it was, you know, we were handling one to three shootings. Wasn't it all unusual to handle one to three shootings per night? Right. And that's not including the bludgeonings and the stabbings and the rat packings and the murders and robberies and all the rest of that stuff. And we were doing a hell of a job. It's just, but there was just no way 40 guys were going to put a cap on this insanity. So the lieutenant was catching hell from upstairs. You know, the mayor was pissed off. The city council was pissed off. They got into the chief's face. The chief, you know, everything runs downhill. So this lieutenant, like any good crook, starts cooking the books. And what I mean by that is that he was rewriting the criterion of what constituted a gang-related shooting. And it got so dishonorable that half the unit transferred out. And once you get into a, you know, into a specialized unit, you don't transfer out. It got that bad. Well, I wasn't going anywhere. I was crushing it.
Yeah.
And so at one point, the lieutenant called me in his office and he says, you know, you haven't been abiding by the new regulations, what have you. So he transfers me out of the unit, what they call administrative transfer, to Northeast Division. Well, I grieved at the Protective League and I got back into the unit about 3 months later, calls me into the office and says, you know, Marino, you're on the menu. And I said, oh, shit. And it was at that time that I said, you know, I better go speak to somebody that you know, that has a superior position to him. So I went to the commander of the bureau, the boss of all five divisions, Commander Croker, and I laid it all out. And Croker says, you know, Al, we've known about this for, you know, for a long time, but nobody's had the reproductive organs enough to come in and tell us that. Mm-hmm. Do you have anybody that'll back your story up? Well, we had four sergeants, and two of the sergeants were just really honorable men. And they threw their careers under the bus because they backed up everything that I said.
Wow.
So the word was out that there was going to be possibly what they call a board of inquiry and heads were going to roll. And it was just at that time that I was working homicide and I was on call and I got beeped up on a drive-by murder where three Avenue's gang members cut this 16-year-old kid in half with a sawed-off shotgun and a 357 Magnum.
Right.
And it was one of the more gruesome murders because it was a belly shot. So he had voided all his intestines and right in front of his mom and dad's home. And when we got there, when I got there, it was just mayhem. I mean, just imagine visually what you were looking at.
Yeah. You can't unsee that stuff. Huh?
My partner was... So my partner, they beeped him up, but that's before, obviously, way before, you know, iPhones. And he didn't answer his beep. So this new guy that came into the unit... And he was a detective three, he outranked me. And the caliber of officers that we were getting into the unit at that time were not of the same,
not the same quality as when you started.
The same quality. No.
Right.
So anyhow, to make that long story short, we worked 28 straight hours on that murder, and we did a search warrant, and we got the main shooter, the one with a sawed-off shotgun. And we still had the guy with the 357 Magnum and the driver. And, so I told my partner, I says, look, we got a kid that actually was next to the decedent when he was blown out of his shoes. So he actually told us, and that was extremely rare. I mean, really extremely rare. I think maybe two or three other times the whole time where we crashed that ever happened. So I says, we don't need to talk to this guy. I know who he is. His brother is the head of La M in the joint. Okay, so these weren't nickel dime gangsters. These were the top of the top. Oh, I mean, they're ruthless animals.
Yeah.
So I said, let's just book him. We'll get a couple hours sleep. Come back, and then we'll see if we can't find the other two gang members. They go, no. We're gonna go in there and play the good guy bad guy routine. I said, no, we're wasting our time. I'm tired. Let's get out of here. But he outranked me, so I said, walked back in there, and I knew the suspect because I had arrested him before.
Right.
And so he told me, looked at me with these dead, ugly black eyes, and he was still like on a sexual high from that murder that he had done just, you know, hours earlier. Wow. And so I start pounding on the table, kicking the chair, and he just looks at me and he goes, "Frick you."
Wow. You know,
so I got him by the collar, pushed him against the wall, pushed him towards the chair, and stormed out. And then this is where your partner's supposed to say, you know what, you're really pissed off, you know, detective, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you're looking at 30 years, you better cooperate with us. Well, he didn't do that, this new guy that came in. And he came out and he told me, you know, Marino, you physically assaulted that arrestee under color of authority, and I'm going to the old man.
Wow.
With our lieutenant that I was at war with. Now, pushing and grabbing the murder suspect, is that wrong? Of course it is. But you got to put this thing into perspective. You know, there was no injury. There was nothing. End of story. And the bail schedule for that kind of thing is, you know, your supervisor comes up to you, says, you know, we don't do that. And you say, won't happen again. End of story. That didn't happen. 2 weeks later, I went to the Colorado River with a bunch of cops, stewardess, and nurses, and their girlfriends and wives and stuff. And there were, I think, seven of us. And we were just bar hopping down the Colorado River, having a great time water skiing. And then at night, we went out for something to eat. And we went into this one bar that we had never heard of before. It's called the Moonshine. Well, when we walk in there, instantly, the cops, not the citizens that we were with, we knew that, oh, shit, we got to get out of here. It was a hangout for the Aryan Brotherhood.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, right. So there was this one guy, the main suspect was Jerry Hallam, a.k.a. the Skull Crusher. He was 6'4", 260 pounds, that didn't have a shirt on, and he didn't do that because he wanted to show off his battle scars from the years that he'd caused all the mayhem that he had. And he had just paroled from prison for cutting his wife's fingers off with an axe.
Oh, my God.
Anyhow, he knew that we were coppers, and after we had a drink, said, we'll just get the hell out of here. So we did the right thing. We were leaving the bar. I was the last guy out, and before I got to the door, he grabs me, starts to take a swing at me. I went at him. I was in fear for my life.
Yeah.
And I went at him like a Tasmanian devil, and it was just one hell of a bar fight. After the fight, we ran out towards where our boat was docked, and he ran to his vehicle, and he brought out a double-barrel shotgun and came running after us.
Jeez.
So we all jumped in the river, and, you know, thank God none of us were killed.
Right.
So I get back to work, and the department got these two allegations of me pushing the gang member,
right,
and being in the fight with this ex-con that came at us with a sawed-off shotgun,
right,
and said we're going to initiate a internal affairs investigation, and I said, oh shit,
yeah.
So anyhow, the two investigators that were assigned to conduct the investigation were overheard by one of the secretaries there that was a really good friend to one of the secretaries in our crash office. And she said, Al, and she told our secretary to tell Al that, you know, watch your ass, because the main one of the two investigators said, we're going to fry Marino's ass. And this is before you start the investigation. So it wasn't an up-and-up investigation. A week later, one of my prior training officers, when I was boot in Venice Division, and he was working in internal affairs at that time as one of the advocates. So those are the guys that put on the cases against the officers. And he says, hey, Al, I just heard the advocate that's going to do the case against you saying that Marino, quote unquote, Marino is going to be fired regardless of the evidence. So, and by the way, when the internal affairs was talking or interviewing this victim, this animal that had, you know, chopped off his wife's fingers off with an axe and a 9-page rap sheet came at us with a sawed-off shotgun, he told the same two internal investigators that he already found out from La EMA, the Mexican Mafia, that I was working gangs, and that when he found me, he was going to kill me. They didn't take him into custody for attempted murder.
Right.
And because he had fulfilled the, you know, the elements, he'd already, you know, started the process of finding out where I was and, you know, to kill me. They didn't take him into custody. So they went back. They told their lieutenant told their captain, captain told the bureau commander, went up to the chief's office, and they did not. This, if I didn't have the evidence, by the way, and the documents, nobody would ever in a million years believe this. But they did not furnish me the standard security protocol where they have Metropolitan Division sitting out in front of your house 24/7 and also your parents' house. Then you have Robbery Homicide Division conducting an investigation, getting a wiretap on this guy. And they have LAPD's SIS following this guy 24/7. Zero, nothing. In essence, the LAPD sanctioned the Aryan Brotherhood to murder one of their own.
Yeah, yeah. And that's crazy, wow. You know. Now, you're saying you didn't have any evidence. I mean, there were people there with you, right? That saw
I'm sorry?
This. There were people with you when you had this fight with him, right? So you had
yeah, there were seven of us.
Right,
yeah,
there so there were witnesses yeah. and stuff, right?
They took they flew in these ex-cons from Arizona, and they were all through the corrupt Board of Rights. Also, I left that out. Right. They took the word of these ex-cons versus.
Your word.
The word of yeah. their own officers.
Yes.
And they, I mean, it, you know, you're going to have to read the book, L.A.'s Last Street Cop, and it is so well documented
right.
and written. And if I didn't have that, those records from the Los Angeles Police Department, like I said, nobody would believe it in a million years.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's a book that is kind of like L.A. Confidential because it brings in City Hall, the mayor, you know, corrupt. Officials in the department, but I'm not understand this, that I am not talking about my brothers and sisters that are working those black and whites 24/7, putting their lives on the line. I'm not talking about them. They're the finest human beings that God ever created, but I'm talking about a handful of people where the department was going to basically be exposed for underreporting those gang crimes, and they went postal when I did that, when I blew the whistle. But right. they didn't call it whistleblowing back then in the day, but that's what they call it today.
Yeah, yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah, well, you've been through quite a bit, let me tell you. So, well, we won't ask you how this ended because obviously we want people to read the book. And but this is enough to tease us into wanting to read this.
Yeah, definitely. I want to make this a film. That's where my mind always goes.
And so, Al, the book is LA's Last Street Cop. Let's just a couple minutes. How are you affected by the situation of what's going on today? The LAPD is under a lot of pressure, a lot of criticism and stuff. You know, like you said, obviously most cops are like angels, you know, I mean, the stuff you have to deal with, and people don't understand, you defund the police department, who's going to stand between us and the criminals, you know? So that's my view. How do you feel about it?
Well, you know, the actions that one officer took by placing his knee over, and by the way, they don't teach you that in the academy by any stretch of the imagination.
Really?
No. Once a guy's handcuffed and he's down, what you do is you pick his ass up, put him in the car, get the hell out of there, and book him.
Yeah.
I just, it was repugnant, disgusting, and every police officer that I know coppers from not only throughout the U.S., but I've been to different other countries and talked to them, and every law enforcement officer is just absolutely beside themselves in disgust.
Right.
However, you know, the way this thing is being has developed to is where they're actually telling the public that you have to be very careful for your lives because the policemen are going to that they're the problem, which is insanity. There are over 436 million contacts between the law enforcement agency, the 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the U.S. every year, 240,000 calls for service. Somebody want, you know, they call, they have a problem, and 190 traffic stops. And when you calculate that with a population of 328 million Americans, your chances of being hurt by a police officer are 0.0002293, principally non-existent. And of course, you don't hear this.
No.
It's just that, you know, and I go back to the Watts riots. I mean, I was living in the curfew zone in the 1965 Watts riots.
Wow.
And then, of course, the 92 riots and then the other riots. And you know, there's and one other thing, you just don't hear almost anything about the nine officers that have been butchered on the street since that incident, about the over 21,000 officers to date that have been injured and some of them still in the hospital. I mean, there is no, I don't have any problem with people demonstrating. That's our constitutional rights. And we've got graves all around the world with men and women that have given their lives so that we can do this sort of thing. But what's happening, where they're destroying, in many cases, you know, communities that can't afford to be destroyed, murdering people, taking over cities, is just completely gone. I mean, all the four wheels are just, they're off. It's nuts. It's insane.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the thing, is that there's so much, so much that the police does for us that I don't see how we could survive without the police, you know, and without respecting them as well. You know, I mean, you heard the police union chief talking the other day, and he says, you know, you guys are treating us with no respect, no nothing, and I'm sure it hurts, you know.
Sam, of everything you just said, there was one word that really, really is critically important, is that when you say respect, now you're right, not respecting the dude or the guy or the woman that's being in, we're talking about the uniform that represents law and order in a society that makes us different from the caveman days.
Right.
The way it is that through the, what's happened today is that when there's no more or little respect that when a policeman stops you. Today, everybody wants to challenge you for whatever they stop. Like, what did you stop me for? Or you're violating my, and what happens is it just escalates a situation that where you can get a ticket, sign it, and you're out of your, you know, you're on your way.
Right.
But there, it just calls for confrontation and escalation. And I mean, what the hell does a policeman do after somebody, you stop for something and the guy turns around and says, you know, screw you, you're violating my constitutional rights. And look what you did here with this guy over in Minneapolis. And it's just the breeding ground for this thing to even get worse right now, because there is no law and order or respect or support.
Right. No
for
support for
law enforcement throughout the United States. And I just have no idea how this thing is going to end.
I know. I'm pretty frightened myself.
I think people are having a hard time feeling respect. And of course, there are great cops. And of course, there are bad cops, just like there's great people and bad people. I think people are kind of, you know, stuck between what to do at the moment in time, you know, because of what people are seeing. And the stories that are being told.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you're entirely correct. And there are, unfortunately, historically, there have been bad policemen. And there's some bad policemen, you know, as we're speaking here today.
Sure.
My thought is that, you know, this thing about the silence thing and the blue wall, I mean, that's a bunch of bullshit. If I ever seen a cop that was doing something that was going to basically dishonor my brothers and sisters, I would roll him over to internal affairs so fast it'd make your head spin. And that was my personal experience from all the seven divisions that I worked. I had, if I seen anything akin to that, and I was a hard-ass street cop, by the way, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have any problem in basically, you know, telling management about some jerk out there that's screwing up.
Right.
I'm 74 years old. And God knows that I've been in the cauldron of some shit all my life, but I have never truly seen it this bad, and it just breaks my heart. I love this country so much.
Yeah.
And it just, there's so many good people, you know, around. And it's just, you know, there are forces right now that are just tearing the soul. And what really bothers me is if you look at Russia and China and the rest of these countries, they're just slapping their knee and getting a fantastic laugh out of this thing.
Right.
It's just horrible.
Right, right. Well, Al, we're out of time. Al Moreno, the book is L.A.'s Last Street Cop. And this is probably available anywhere there's books, like Amazon and all that.
Anywhere there's books.
Right. And Al, did the book just come out recently?
The book was launched on the 4th, but, you know, there's, you know, dealing with this corona thing and then now dealing with this thing, you know, it's just kind of backing the wheels up of all procedures, including, you know, getting the information out there. There's just, it's this... This whole thing is taking the oxygen out of just a normal time when somebody comes out with what I think is going to be a bestseller,
right?
Because the book is true and it's incredible. But hopefully, when things simmer down, things will pick up. But in the meantime, you know, talking to wonderful people like yourself that are a bit on the cheeky side,
right.
I really enjoyed this. But listen, thank you so much for having me on.
Of course.
Thanks for coming on and talking with us.
Yeah, and the book is so relevant right now, you know, that it's literally at the top of everybody's mind these days, you know. So I want to thank you for sharing this with us, Al. We salute you for all the service. I mean, between your service in Vietnam and in the LAPD, I think you've earned your place in heaven, let's say, you know. You've done more than most people do for other people. So we appreciate that. We want to thank you for that.
And for persevering through your challenges. I think that's really inspiring.
Well, you know, I really, really appreciate it from, you know, hearing something like that from folks like you. You know, it just, you've made my day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Al. Thank you again. And you're welcome back anytime when the virus is over. If you'd like to come in and spend some more time with us, I'd love to hear more of your stories. I mean,
I'd love to.
Yeah, you've been through everything and back, so... All right, Al.
Thanks again.
To you, and stay strong and safe.
All right. Bye-bye, guys. Bye. Take care.
Bye. Take care.
Wow. See, this is interesting. I mean, we spent a lot of time with him, which...
Yeah, I mean, he had a lot to say, which I think is really cool.
You know, and I never really talked to a cop, you know, to get their point of view and stuff, you know. And what's interesting is... you know, that he's, I mean, he's 74 years old, but, and he's done so much in his life. And, I mean, can you imagine just the adversity of growing up in a family with 12 kids, I mean, and poor?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, what are your chances of really coming out of there halfway a decent human being?
I mean, you have to hope that people can, I mean, they're like, you know, probably more ways than two, but at least two ways you can come out of a situation, right? Like, you can come from a rough background and lean into it, or you can go the opposite direction and use it to inspire yourself to have a different life. And I know that sounds cliche, but it's very true.
No, but it's true, you know, because he grew up in the same place that those gang members grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how people can go either way.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that someone, you know, young already knows and realizes that I don't want to take that path. I want to take this one.
Yeah. And someone who actually follows what they feel in their gut. I feel like a lot of people go against their instincts.
Right.
And it never lands them in a right place for them.
Yeah. You know, and he put his position on the line by going to superiors and everything. And, you know, so I don't know what else you can expect from someone in public service, you know, but, you know, and I got to tell you, when I came to this country, I realized that cops here are serious, you know, they don't mess around, you know. In Israel during those times, it was like there was corruption, there was things like that. I mean, I don't know how bad it was, but still, if you knew somebody who knew somebody, then you can get away with a lot of things, you know.
Sure.
But here... you just don't have that, you know, or at least not as a way of life, you know, not as the norm.
Maybe, yeah.
And I realized that, so I've always respected policemen. I think for the most part, they're good. And you have to remember what they deal with. I mean, you heard them, you know.
They do have a lot.
Worst human beings, you know. They're evil. And what are you going to do, you know? You got to err on the safe side. But, you know, that's for the day. That's it. There was a lot of things to talk about, but this was much cooler, I think.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you this. A Thai restaurant in Thailand, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's two owners of a restaurant. They were given 723 years in prison because they had a seafood scam. 723 years for... giving out coupons that they couldn't honor in the restaurant. And they're actually, this was taken down. They actually got a, it was reduced from 1,400 years.
Like, that's kind of a joke to me.
It is, right?
I can't even get the words out. Like, it's like, I just, like, no one should get more than 100 years.
Yeah.
Like, it should be a cap out at 100.
Wow.
You know, and that's assuming you live to, you know, you go into prison at 20 and you might live to 120.
Right.
That's like max, although I don't anticipate anyone really survives that long in prison and also in regular life. Most people don't live that long. But I feel like to give someone like 720 years, you're like,
yeah,
okay, haha, I get it. Like, just say life.
Right.
Just say life in prison.
They're saying, though, that, you know, Thai law means they will not serve more than 20 years in prison. But, you know, I mean, we have it here, too, where you get, like, so many years because they give you a specific number of years for every charge that they charge you with.
I know.
So it adds up like that. But, I mean, 1,400 years, come on. I mean, and this is for just for a business fraud, you know. It's not like they murdered somebody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so
and to think how long people have gone away for in America just for smoking marijuana.
Right. So that's why actually I'm happy to live here. I don't think I would live anywhere else. It just scares me too much, all those laws.
Maybe
know?
New Zealand or something. They seem to kind of have it together.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It seems okay
but
there.
But there's drawbacks there too.
I'm
know?
Sure. I mean, there no the place is perfect.
From, yeah, they're far know? From everything and stuff. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's better places, but... I like the fact that I'm here and I have the freedom that I do. But we'll see. All that is being threatened right now, so we'll see what happens. Anyway.
Tomorrow is unknown.
Yeah.
Will we be here tomorrow?
Tomorrow's Friday, yeah. So yeah, we'll be here tomorrow.
Cool. All right. All I ask is my birthday's Monday. Let's please do a show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I want to do a show Monday.
Well, thanks for letting me know. I didn't realize it was.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Well, see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, only on LA Talk Radio.